What is going on, everyone? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. I'm your host, Curry Blanford, and today I'm talking to Aaron Nyquist. So Aaron is a liturgist, writer, author, podcaster, pastor, all around kind of good guy. This episode's a ton of fun just because we get into so much of Aaron's story. It's an awesome story of sort of like finding struggles within the church, like being sort of in ministry and struggling and just really seeing God like come through and sort of like just flip his vocation in a lot of ways, like doing the same thing, but just in a very different way. And so in this episode, we talk about how ministry was healing for Aaron, which is not true for a lot of pastors, but he found himself in a place where he could heal. And that is very much my story in a lot of ways. And so we really connect on that point. And we just talk about the contemplative life, about what it is to like really practice these practices that are about spiritual formation. And so there's a lot of in-depth material in this one. Aaron has journeyed for a long time and now does a lot of work around liturgy and contemplation and some of these practices. And I really encourage you, if you haven't stepped into some of these, maybe it's a good time to try, especially in this season of quarantine. Like, silence is a really amazing discipline, not an easy one by any stretch of the imagination, not one I'm good at myself, but it's an incredible practice. And so there's lots of resources in this episode, and there's just really good story. I think you're really gonna love hearing from him. So I just want to remind you to make sure you're following me on Instagram and Facebook at Theology of Hustle, and on Twitter at Curry Blanford, to stay up to date with what we got going on Theology of Hustle and all the great new episodes coming out. We have amazing stuff coming up this summer, amazing people coming. So make sure you're in the know about all of that stuff. And I hope you enjoy hearing from Aaron. All right. Hey, Aaron, thanks for coming on the podcast and chatting with me, man. This is fun.
Glad to do it.
That's awesome. So let's just jump off and have you sort of give the quick rundown. Just introduce yourself to everyone.
Okay. The quick rundown, my whole life story in T-minus.
It should be easy. Well, you could just kind of tell us maybe like what you do now.
Yeah. I mean, the story in terms of kind of my vocation in the world is I grew up in a very conservative Christian tradition, and a lot of goodness to it and a lot of not goodness to it, but grew up in that. And then when I went to Christian college, and then right out of college, I got a job at a church, and then my faith completely imploded. And that was really fun when you're getting paid to lead songs that you don't believe anymore, you know,
right. Yeah.
Very complicated. But thanks be to God, through a couple friends, through a couple books, through I realized that the story was so much bigger than I had believed. And in fact, much of what I was rejecting was good to reject. And then much of what I found in place of that was so much more beautiful. Yeah. And so I would say since then, so much of my vocation, whether I get paid for it or not, is trying to remind people, you know, the way of Jesus is really beautiful.
Yeah,
amen. And modern Christianity is largely a disaster right now. And there's a lot changing and breaking and falling apart and being reborn. But Jesus was right about everything. And so we can find his invitation, and then, you know, we can build for a new world. So
Yeah, that's good. I like that. I can't wait to jump into more of that story. I was just, as you were talking though, we both grew up, I think, we're very similar ages under the, what is the, oh my gosh, Brian McLaren, the emerging church, whatever, depending on, I was at Moody when that was going down, was going to wreck everything.
Oh,
right?
But
looking back on the emerging church and all that stuff, I think there was some like really good movement to it, right? Like there was a lot of deconstruction going on, right?
Yes.
The thing that I think the emerging church didn't do so well necessarily was rebuild per se, you know, it was only a deconstructionist movement.
Yeah.
And so I think what you're talking about, though, is like breaking down some of these things that ought to be and then rebuilding them from there.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. Oh, I have no interest in deconstruction without reconstruction.
Right.
That's
right.
Just demolition. That's right. Anybody can do that. Anybody can blow up a building. That's not hard. But to rebuild something better, that's compelling.
Right.
But I would say you can't rebuild before you've taken some things down.
Totally agree.
And so, I mean, like a number of Brian's books in particular were really, really important to me.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
I had to like sneak them into campus, you know.
you could be in a lot of trouble for having those.
Yeah, right.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
No, but I think you're totally right. For sure. So what was it? Okay. So you're leading worship at a church, you're doing ministry, which I assume is something you've sort of always been told and wanted to do. What was that moment like when you sort of realized that like none of it made sense or you didn't agree with some of the songs or whatever?
Well, I've had two kind of, you know, you've had hundreds of disillusion moments, but I had two major ones.
Yeah.
And the first one was very theological. And then the second one was very, maybe ecclesiological about the church and what we do.
Sure.
But, so are you asking about the theological, that first one?
I'd love to hear one or both, well, or, you know, I'm down for whatever.
The very plain, and then we can jump into more detail, but the very basic idea was I really was raised to believe that the invitation of Christ was believe these three facts so you can go to heaven someday.
Yeah.
And I believe those facts, maybe in a different way, but it was profoundly true. It just wasn't the invitation of Jesus, you know.
Right. Yeah.
Those were a part of his bigger invitation, was participate with the way I'm putting the world back together.
Right.
And once that, that first thing just ran out of gas. I was like, if that's what this whole story is about, come on, that's not going to sustain a life. But once I started getting in touch with the kingdom, the invitation to participate with God for the sake of the world, not just to get my individual soul somewhere someday, but for the whole world. That changed everything.
Yeah.
So that was a big shift. Yeah.
No, I read a bio somewhere. I've been looking all over the interweb or whatever, but you talked about that moment that you realized that it's like it's about the kingdom of God, as opposed to these beliefs. So
that's right.
What did that shift look like for you? Even like practically, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to overstate it because I literally was a Christian my whole life and about to jump ship from the whole thing. I mean, this wasn't a peripheral, you know, I used to be a Sox fan, now I'm a Cubs fan. Like, this was at the center of who I understood myself to be was a Christian person, and it was over. So this new understanding was just it was so seismic that it affected everything. And it, you know, from it changed why I thought we were singing these songs every Sunday.
Right,
it changed why I wanted to be involved in my neighborhood, not just avoid those sinful people. It changed the kinds of books I read. It changed everything.
Right.
And
Yeah, that's cool. What were the like outworkings of that from your story perspective?
Yeah, well, maybe that brings it to the other kind of disillusionment or big transition. Right in that season, I met Rob Bell. He was speaking at our church, and then he actually invited us to come join his church as the worship leader. And so we joined up with the Mars Hill community. And at that time, Rob was, it was all kingdom. It was very Dallas Willard. It was, I mean, just so breathtakingly beautiful and compelling. Yeah. And this sweeping vision he was reminding us. And then, but I showed up and all I had was my couple pop songs.
Sure.
Like the tools in my toolbox as a worship leader were built for that old world. Or not old, just more narrow understanding of the story.
Sure. Yeah.
And so right away at Mars Hill, I was like, oh my, he's painting this Van Gogh and I have one marker. So I've got to move from four pop songs and a hymn to some other way of engaging the width and the depth of this invitation with God and each other. And so that kind of propelled me out of how do we do a rock and roll rally, which is not bad. There's nothing wrong with that. Right. But how do we move beyond just that to a more formative, transformational type experience? So,
For sure. Well, because I think the kind of Christianity that you're talking about, which I think I'm probably a part of in spheres and whatnot, is, but there's a, I think the term is an inch deep and a mile wide, right?
Yeah.
Like there's not, there's only so far you can go in that, right? The easy believism, the like, you know, this say the prayer and everything's sort of taken care of sort of scenario, right?
Sometimes I think about it. One of my sons is in third grade and third grade is brilliant and necessary when you're eight.
Right.
Without third grade, you can't get to fourth grade or fifth grade or college or, you know. So the only danger is if a teacher were to ever say to my son, this is the entire story of education. And I think that's what we're missing. There are all these different kinds, parts of the journey and different faith traditions that are really good in that part of the journey. And as long as they understand they're not the end, they're part of the journey, they're really, really valuable. But the second they think and tell people that this is the end point, they're really dangerous.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, yeah, you're right. That's a, like a perfect analogy. That's super helpful for sort of understanding that because there is, there is something to all of that. Yeah, that's good. It's good. So what were some of these toolbox that you started sort of putting in the toolbox?
Yeah. Well, if the only tool I had when I showed up at Mars Hill was four pop songs and a hymn, or sometimes I joke, I had three different songs. I had loud songs, louder songs, and even louder songs. You know, we just started realizing, again, that is so helpful for people who are feeling triumphant and want to thank God. Like, that's really good.
Yeah.
But if you're brokenhearted, that pep rally is really offensive and can actually communicate there's something wrong with you and your broken heart. Yeah. Well, the Psalms didn't do that. A third of the Psalms are lament, making space for the full range of the human experience with God. And so we just wanted to expand the, I mean, that's probably a good way to say it, expand the range of human experience with God. And so we began, we started doing a confession and an assurance. We noticed almost every other Christian tradition has a moment where we confess and then are reminded of God's grace. Why don't we? And so we experimented with that. We experimented with moments of quiet. We experimented with moments of great celebration. We just tried to spread it out. And in fact, this was helpful to me. In that era, my wife asked me, like, why are we doing all these other things? Like, why are we doing a prayer that we read? Why are we doing this? And I tried to explain it to her, oh, the liturgy of the, you know, and she's like, oh, wait. So basically you want to serve a well-balanced meal every Sunday. I was like, that is so good. I've been serving the same meal every Sunday for years and it's a good meal. And we'll continue to serve it on occasion, but we also need some vegetables and we need some dessert and we need a starch and we, you know, if we're going to become healthy, healthy Christians. So.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. Again, with the analogies, man, good work. I love it. That's helpful. Okay. So you're at Mars Hill and you're sort of like bringing all these elements in, right? Was that sort of the building blocks for sort of what you are doing now?
It's where it started. It started when I realized that, the tools I had were not enough for this grand vision. But upon reflection, I also realized that in that era, you know, the whole church was built around Rob's teaching. And he's one of the greatest teachers I've ever heard still to this day.
Yeah.
But I realized that even for me, the whole idea of what is Rob going to do again next week doesn't sustain you for very long. You know, for probably about a year and a half, it transformed my life, my faith, my understanding about the way of Jesus. But at a certain point, I was just like, you know, he's going to say something amazing next week again, but I don't actually know what to do with it.
Right.
And so again, I couldn't have said it at the time, but those were the seeds of moving into a more practice-based faith. Not everyone can say brilliant things like Rob can say, but everyone can pray the examine. Everyone can practice centering prayer. And so I those were the beginnings of seeing my job as how do I do amazing spiritual things for people? Shifting to how do I empower every single person here to be able to do these spiritual things all week long? And that was when we're talking vocation, my vocation shifted.
Yeah.
From how am I going to blow your mind to what tools am I going to put in your toolbox that you don't even need what we're doing every Sunday. So
that's good. Yeah. I do want to point out though,
yeah,
that it's very difficult to become a celebrity pastor doing it that way. Just so you're aware.
Well, as if the goal is to become a celebrity pastor.
Right. Right.
And as if celebrity pastors are necessarily creating more good in the world than, right, than none. I mean, it's sketchy out there these days.
It really is. But yeah, the point of what you're doing is giving others the tools,
yeah,
as opposed to like keeping it in the pulpit.
Right.
Which,
right.
Listen, I'm all for preaching. I love
of
preaching.
Course. Yeah.
And but at the same time, like preaching cannot sustain you week after week after week.
No, nope.
It really can't.
Have you read much Jamie Smith, James K.A. Smith?
I have not. Yes.
But his book, Desiring the Kingdom, was one of the most transformative books for me. And his basic observation is, I mean, we're learning in education, we're learning in all these different spheres of human kind of brain science and just developmentally, that information doesn't change people.
Right.
Information is really important in helping shape our hearts and the things we love. And that's what changes us. And so he talks about, anyways.
No, I think,
you're but a totally lot of our churches are still operating under that old education system where get the most compelling person to do the most compelling lecture and that will change people, and it doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah. It was really interesting. So I was a youth pastor for about 10 years. So I started asking my students, I was like, what is like the best part about church for you? You know, and we're a small mobile church, like 150 people, you know?
Yeah.
And they kept saying like communion, you know? And I'm like, it blew my mind because I walk into a service and I'm looking at the worship, like how good's the sermon?
Right,
like, does it need to be critiqued theologically? Right. You know, but the power and the transformation of the sacraments, was what was speaking to our kids.
That's
and
right.
I'm like, whoa, you know, I didn't have a category for that.
Absolutely. We have unlimited access to all the information in human history on our smartphones.
Right. Yeah.
It's already in our pockets. So I think there is some really helpful work that a teacher does in helping discern and cultivate. Yeah. And so, I mean, I'm not anti-teaching at all.
Sure.
I just think it is a part of the process, not the end goal. In fact, one of my seminary professors, who is a lifetime Episcopalian, just said in class the other day, he goes, "Oh, we don't go to church for a sermon. I mean, if the sermon is coherent, that's bonus.
Right.
We're there for the sacrament. We're here to gather around the table to." And it was just such a stark shift from my tradition, which is what's happening next Sunday. So-and-so's speaking on this, you know?
Yeah. Right.
So, yeah,
totally. I was in a preaching cohort with a Lutheran, like a very, you know, and he was like, "You preach for like 45 minutes or half hour or whatever."
Yeah.
He was like, "Ours are like 8 to 10 max," you know? And I was just like,
"Yes,
I don't even know. That's like my intro." You know, I'm not really sure.
Right. Right.
But it is fascinating.
Yep.
In that. So I think there's a lot of people out there, like liturgy is sort of becoming hot, right? Like, there's lots of amazing books being written on it.
Yep.
I think there's a move towards a more liturgical high church feel for millennials, especially.
Yeah, definitely.
Can you explain like even what liturgy is and like, Yeah.
Yeah. Well, two things I'd say about that. One is a percentage of liturgy being cool is about aesthetic style.
Okay.
And in my opinion, that's fine, but that will come and go really quick. And then there'll be a new aesthetic that's cool. And then it'll be Billie Eilish type worship. And then there'll be a new, you know. Yeah. So that's, I'm not down on that, but I don't take that super seriously. Sure. But there is a whole nother part of the movement towards liturgy that is more about formation. Mm. That is saying whatever we do over and over and over forms us into certain kinds of people, which is why, first of all, every church is liturgical, because every church has a rhythm that we do over and over and over. The question is not, are you liturgical? The question is, how does your particular liturgy form your people?
That's, yeah.
And that's the question that has haunted me, because I was the guy creating the triumphant, bigger and better, louder and cooler, positive, no dead air. Like I was making those things. And I will say this every time, it's not bad. It's just not enough. It's not the whole story. It is one color, and we need the whole color wheel. And so so for me, liturgy, simply one definition of liturgy is simply the work of the people. It's what we do when we come together. And the question I was trying to ask is, if you are a part of our liturgy for any length of time, what kind of person do you become?
Right. Yeah.
And which is, you know, to go back to the idea of lament, if you're a part of a church that never, ever makes space for your sorrow, that is going to form you into the kind of person that either shames yourself anytime you feel sad, oh, I must not have faith, I must be a bad Christian, or it's going to make you repress it, or it's going to make you act out and jump shit. Like, it's going to form you into some way,
right?
But it's a total unnecessary crisis, because our faith is made for people who are weeping,
right?
Yeah. and celebrating,
yeah.
Yeah,
man, that's good. I hadn't even ever really kind of considered that part of it, because and I think people look at liturgy, right, and those who are unacquainted with it say, why would I want to do the same thing like every week?
Right.
Right. Like, what do you say to that?
Well, if you go to the gym and do the bench press one time, how does that, are you in shape? You know, no, of course.
I like to think so.
Oh, yeah, I know, me too. Or I like to not even go and think I'm in shape.
Yeah, it's easier that way. Yeah.
But, so I mean, there's just a nature of reality, of humanity, that we are what we practice. So what we do over and over and over. Now, to use the same analogy, if you do the exact same exercise, the exact same way indefinitely, at a certain point, it does, your body adapts and it plateaus and stops being helpful. And I think there's something instructive for us in the tradition I grew up in. One of my colleagues used to say, I think our motto is never do the same thing once, which I think is pretty funny. Were like, it's about novelty. It's about innovation. Yeah. It's about surprise them, you know? Well, now I'm at an Episcopalian seminary. Right. And I think a lot of what they're saying is, you know, we have the plan. Yeah. Let's do it. Let's keep doing it. And there is a beauty in that, especially for someone like me. But there's also, there's a rigidity, and there's a there can be a disconnect from actual life.
Yeah.
And so for me, what I'm dreaming about, what I'm trying to work with in my own work and with others, is how do we bring the gifts of multiple traditions together? So we need the Episcopal, the depth of the liturgy. You know, they don't say in an hour-long mass, there's not a single word or hand gesture that hasn't been thought through theologically. Mm. I mean, it is just brilliant. Mm. But holy smokes, sometimes the pastor is more, the priest is more bored than we are. And I mean, it's just, so And then you go to a really modern type church where it's all sparklers and cheerleading.
Right.
And it moves our hearts, but it's like cotton candy. There's nothing there. Yeah. And so I refuse to choose either one of those bad options. Anyways, so trying to bring these things into conversation and intersection.
Yeah, you're totally right. I totally agree. Sorry, there's just so many thoughts swirling in my head.
Oh,
right.
Yeah,
now,
yeah. Let's keep talking.
I love this conversation.
Yeah.
Because there's a sin. Oh, because this is exactly what the church year does, right? Though, like observing the church calendar, right?
Yeah.
It leaves, like, we're in Lent right now.
Right.
And like this leaves time for lament.
It's exactly
leading up
right.
to the resurrection,
yep.
right?
Yep. That's exactly right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's why some of the church year stuff, particularly, I don't think is about cool style, is about community saying, what we're doing isn't working. We need deeper streams. And the church has been swimming in these deeper streams for generations. It's us who have lost it.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, when do you ever repent? Like, outside of like being drawn into that place.
Exactly right. Yeah.
Right.
But the church offers a safe space to, and for me, again, this was novel back in the Mars Hill days. I didn't realize, I'd heard about confession, of course, but I'd never heard about the assurance and the wisdom of our kind of forebearers to say, yes, let's make space to confess our sin, but always together with the remember. As far as the east is from the west, you know, it's both. We need both.
Yeah.
And so something really beautiful about that too.
Yeah. It's the gospel, right?
Right. I mean,
it's
the story.
The gospel,
right? That's right. That's right.
Be assured your sins are forgiven, you know, because Jesus.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good stuff.
Yeah.
Cause there's a significant, I don't know if you've seen this, but there's a significant disconnect that I think most Christians have with our past, with our the history of even the church. You know, we have like 2,000 years of people who have been doing this and doing it really well. And we know nothing aside from the last, you know, 20, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like whatever's hot right now.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. The early church is like the mid-80s.
Right.
So, yep. Yep. And again, here's what's complicated. I mean, multiple things are true. Those who rejected the past rejected a lot of things that needed to be rejected.
Right. Yeah.
So they weren't crazy, but I think they were really short-sighted in doing an either or approach.
Right. Oh, it's a pendulum swing,
a
right?
A pendulum always, swing, right. Now that old stuff was all bad, and now we're going to do something that's all good. Yeah. Well, we're doing the same with that thing now, but what I'm pleading, both with myself, because I have just as much pendulum swing propensity, but with us to say, there's actually, our grandparents' church had a lot of wisdom to it.
Right. Yeah.
And our parents' church, which is often the most triggering, has a lot of goodness to it.
Right.
And so how do we, it's that whole, I wrote about that in my book, The Eternal Current. How do we include and transcend?
Yeah.
So the last step is not enough, but it got us here.
Right.
So we don't need to reject it wholesale. We need to include it into the bigger story.
Yeah. And how do we do that with integrity? And
that's right.
Right. I think that's important stuff to think through. Cause you just did a liturgy around the Nicene Creed. Is that right?
Yes.
That I saw.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
It came out of one of my classes. We were studying the creed. And again, growing up in my tradition, we didn't talk about the creed or really focus on that. And so I was, as we dove into it, all these things started coming to life and, the compelling nature of it, even the parts of it that really don't kind of resonate with me, just the beauty of what it's trying to do. And so I said, well, rather than just read it, I want to create this 45-minute way that we embody it. Mm. And so we actually got to do it maybe a month ago with a community, maybe 30 of us on a Wednesday night. It was a beautiful experience.
That's pretty cool. I love that. I mean, that Nicene Creed like lays out foundationally sort of everything we believe, right? Like,
And like 1500 years ago. Yeah. I mean, more than that actually. Yeah. I mean,
it was 320.
Yeah. That's exactly right.
323.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, it's been around a long time.
Yeah.
And it still resonates.
Well, and these are the things like we throw around the word like heresy, I think way too often.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous, but those are the actual things that like are, those are the majors.
Right.
Right. And we're so disconnected from that, even that Nicene Creed.
That's right.
And what even the majors are.
That's right. You know, one of my, I was a music theory and composition major in college, and one of my, composition professor, or no, theory professors, his refrain was always, you got to learn the rules before you break them. So that's why we studied Bach. That's why we studied the masters, not to redo Bach,
right,
but to know what we're breaking. And I think at least in my tradition, we don't even know what came before. We don't even know the rules we're breaking.
Yeah.
And I think everybody loses because we don't.
Right. Right. Totally. Yeah. Because you talk, I mean, you've hinted or talked a little bit about ancient future stuff, right? Like we exist sort of in this, like, can you talk about like ancient future sort of ideas?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, I think it's the way I talk about it is what I just mentioned, the include and transcend, that the, there's so much recreating the wheel, and we don't need to, because there is wisdom in our past that is so important. It's why when you get to sit down, you know, with a grandparent,
right?
And they start telling stories about the war and then the depression, and you're like, oh my God, there's just a depth there. Now, we're not talking to our grandparents so they can tell us exactly how to live. They don't know how to live right now. Yeah. That's for us to figure out. But you better believe they have, we ignore their wisdom at our own peril.
Yeah.
And so I think that's some of the ancient future. For me, I often just try to look back and say, what have been some of the constants? And that's where, you know, just us bringing the confession and assurance into our community. We couldn't deny that this was such a central shared practice, both historically, but also as I look around ecumenically, like all these different traditions do it. Why don't we?
Right.
And so now we could still choose to not do it, but we would need to choose to not do it in full view that we're the outliers.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause the ecumenism, I mean, even like totally disconnected from the whole Eastern church, right?
Gosh.
Like,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
it's just,
right,
we are such in a little bubble.
Yes.
And we have, for a lot of us, we have no idea what's out there. You
That's
know,
right.
Even majority world cultures, Latin America, Africa, you know, Asia, where Christianity is booming.
Yes.
Like, we're so divorced from those
so
sorts
true.
Of things.
Yep. We're so isolated. Yeah.
We are. Yeah. Totally. It's good stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I know you talk a lot about like contemplation and contemplative prayer.
Yeah.
I just want to point out that like being in a service and deciding to have complete silence is like one of the most awkward things on the planet, right? Like, we are so unwilling to or unable to cope with silence.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. I mean, our society, that is one of those things where we're swimming in. We're swimming exactly upstream against any sort of reflection, quiet, listening. I mean, so it is a countercultural act to come together and try to let go of the noise and hear the still small voice.
For sure.
Yeah.
So what is that? I mean, what are those sort of, because I mean, silence has been a practice mean, from the beginning, right? So can you talk just a little bit about like contemplation and some of that world?
We actually just did this in the fall. I mentioned this Wednesday night thing that we're doing with our church. We just said we're going to learn two or three historic Christian practices on Wednesday nights. And we're not just going to hear messages about them. We're going to do them. Like, so come and roll up your sleeves. And one of them was silence. And so what we just did is we talked about both from a theological standpoint. I mean, the role, if you look at the role of silence in the scriptures, you keep seeing, I mean, one of the great ones we talked about was the text, you know, and God's voice was, God was not in the hurricane and God was not in the earthquake, but God was in the whisper, the still small voice, and just noting and wondering together, how often is God speaking? And we're just not listening.
Yeah, you're right.
So I don't believe God, once we behave well enough, God's like, all right, well, I'll stop being silent and I'll start talking to him. I think God is constantly beckoning. Yeah. And it's us who occasionally decide to listen. Yeah. So we talked about it theologically, but we also talked about the brain science of what we're learning about what silence does and what lack of silence does to our actual gray matter, the kinds of human beings we are. It's why there's this explosion of mindfulness and these practices, even when they're completely separated from anything religious, human beings are realized, this is how we're made to have these moments. So we usually talk about it both theologically and then just the humanity of it. And then we talk about real concrete ways to do it because it's really difficult. And I think to just throw people into silence is pastoral malpractice. And so we just, we built it week by week. And like 1 week we did 3 different 5-minute sits of silence. And 5 minutes in a group is still a long time, but we had real concrete practices. Like for these 5 minutes, here's the thing, you know. And so we're just trying to resource people. You can do this. You can do this. And it was always hard. Even those of us who try to practice this more often, it's always hard and it always opens something up that otherwise would have stayed closed.
So. Well, maybe we run from that sort of stuff sometimes because we're afraid of what's going to.
Like, we know there's something lurking down there. Like, I'm just going to keep that closed. Thank you very much. And
just
that,
distract myself.
You know. And that works short term. It's going to come out. And we all know that it's either going to come out in these holy spaces or it's going to come out sideways. And, so we don't have a choice if we deal with it. We just have a choice how we deal with it.
No, that's good. That is good. Cause it usually comes out and it breaks down relationships.
It does, and it surprises us and we're not aware of, wait, where did that come from? Why did I just yell at the, you know?
I'm in spiritual direction right now.
And
we're sort of working through. Awesome. I really enjoy it more than I even realized I needed, I think. But we've talked a lot about some of those things in me and like, you know, just when you walk through the, when you walk through the difficult times, like to not have anyone there who sort of gets it and can sort of bounce ideas off, you know, like, it's tough. So especially with kids, right?
Oh, like I know. They don't add quiet to our lives.
No, they don't. We love them, but So what would you suggest to somebody who maybe wants to like dip a toe into sort of contemplation and sort of feel like, you know, maybe this is something they want to do?
For me, it started, and this is maybe more personality than anything, as much as ideas are not ever the end goal. It started with ideas. So it started with reading about it. And this is kind of what I say about ecumenical work too. I was not kind of bold enough to like go to my local Catholic parish and meet the priest, but I could start reading some Catholic theologians. And that opened up all the space like, oh my, you know, it was so, such a helpful thing. So to begin with just reading and learning about it. I mean, one of the classic seminal books is Foster's Spirit of the Discipline. I mean, that's just like, and then Dallas Willard, of course, is a great writer. A recent book, Felina Huritz just wrote a book. I think it's called Silence. I have it up on my, but Felina's new book, and she's okay. really great at talking to non-contemplative communities about contemplative practices. And then, of course, I mean, Richard Rohr, for me, his book, Everything Belongs, that was kind of one of my first introductory books into this whole idea of a more contemplative way of being. And it was really, really helpful.
Yeah, that's good. That's helpful stuff. Because it's super intimidating.
Oh, it right? is. Like, yeah. Yeah.
Especially if you don't have a community that's sort of already on that path, you know, it's tricky.
Yeah. But I totally agree. And that's how I felt for years. But some of it is just the oddness of language. Hmm. Like, you know, the contemplative journey, centering prayer, some of these words can be like, I don't know what that means. Right. But the idea of just cultivating a little quiet in your life.
Yeah.
Like, you can do that.
Sure.
You can do that. And maybe it starts with 3 minutes. I have a friend who every morning is a pastor friend. He reads the text. He reads whatever he's studying or, you know, whatever the text he's looking at. And then he sits for 10 minutes in silence. Mm-hmm. Now, again, he's been doing this a long time. So 10 minutes can be a long time. But he said, that's the moment where I let the scriptures just sink in. It's the moment where I try to let go of all the pressures I'm feeling and the to-do lists. Mm. And he said, I'm just not sure I could do my job and my life without those 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Well, we all can't do 10 minutes, but we could do 2 minutes.
Yeah.
So those who are Christians and reading the text, you know, to read whatever you're reading that morning and just say, I'm going to set the alarm on my phone for 3 minutes. And I'm just going to notice my breath and just listen for 3 minutes. And the first 10 times will be miserable. And you'll say, oh, that was terrible. Nothing happened. But down the road, you'll begin to notice things are shifting in you and opening and softening. I have a friend who says, I never notice the fruit of centering prayer when I'm doing centering prayer. But I do notice it when someone does something that really bugs me and I'm able to respond kindly. I'm like, oh, something is happening in my practice, you know?
Yeah.
So,
No, that's good. That's super helpful. Makes me always think of like St. Anthony, I think it was, that went and lived in a cave for like 40 years something.
Yeah.
You know, like the early monasticism.
Yeah.
You know, like,
It's
kind of mind boggling.
Yeah.
But I think
I could never do that. Yep.
I mean, a minute of silence.
I know.
For me
yeah.
Is
it's
like,
hard.
You know,
yep.
Yeah. Especially when you're an extrovert, you know, you're not like used to that sort of thing.
Right.
You know? So,
right.
That's good. One thing you did talk about too was, you know, when you sort of changed over from where you were to sort of like moving in this new direction.
Yeah.
A part of that was like understanding the role of the Spirit. Like you came to a more charismatic understanding of the world and of God.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's interesting that the more focused I am on the Spirit, the more I'm drawn to older liturgical forms. I think before this journey, I would have thought it was the opposite.
Yeah.
The more Holy Spirit, the more just crazy freedom. Like you know, and it's been exactly the opposite. And one of the people who modeled this to me is my spiritual director. He's a Jesuit priest. And he said to me once, he said, I'm a Catholic charismatic. He said, I am rooted in the historic goodness of our tradition. And I'm always trying to listen to the whispers of the Holy Spirit.
Yeah.
It's both. Mm. And for me, that is so compelling. And so it kind of reminds me, I used to get the question a lot, as a worship leader, are you a prepare person or are you a follow the Spirit person?
Sure.
As if those are different. And what I would always say is what I've learned is the more I prepare, the more I feel freedom in the moment to follow the whisper of the Spirit. If I don't know what I'm doing and flying by the seat of my pants, I'm not listening to God. I'm just trying to get to the next chord change, right?
Right, yeah.
But and I think there's something there about the faith too. When we submit to this bigger container that holds us, that teaches us things we never would have chosen on our own, that, you know, when we're a part of this bigger thing, then there's all this space to respond.
Yeah.
So that's the first answer. Maybe the second answer would be, I think my belief in the need of these practices is because I believe that the Spirit is already doing everything that the Spirit does.
Yeah.
It's us who chooses to open or not. You know, it's like we're already immersed underwater, but we're really thirsty.
Yeah.
And so these practices are humble ways that help us open our mouths and drink to what's already there, which is very different from, God, I'm thirsty in your absence. If I perform spiritual practices, can I earn some of that living water?
Yeah.
We're already soaked. We're drenched. The practices just help us receive it.
Yeah. That's good. That's good stuff. It is always amazing how the role of the Spirit, because I assume where you came from, the Christianity that you're talking about, is what Gordon Fee calls binitarian, right? Like the there's two persons of the Trinity, the Holy Spirit gets left out there. Triunity there.
Or there's still a Trinity. My friend always talks about the Father, Son, and the Holy Bible.
Yeah, right. Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. We're not sure which one's on the highest level, per se. Yep. You know? But yeah, it is. And it is interesting because, so I am a pastor at a church that has roots in the Assemblies of God. So there's a charismatic bent there.
Yeah.
But I find that our culture most closely aligns with that of a local Anglican church. Yeah. Like, we get along really well because there is so much charismatic nature to the liturgy.
That's
which
right.
is counterintuitive, I think.
Yep, it is. It's surprising, but whenever the intersections is where the most interesting things happen, whether it's about art or culture or whatever, but in the spiritual life, when you bring the deep history with the present power, when you bring the known foundation with the wild mystery that cannot be contained, I mean, that is pretty compelling.
That is. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. God, it's just cool how the depth, right?
Like, yeah, right. Right.
You could never plumb the depths, and it's just, there's so much.
Yep.
That's good stuff. Okay. So let's think about a 30,000 foot view of your story, right? Like, how do you sort of think about the trajectory that you've had to go on to sort of get where you are today and what God has sort of brought you through? Does that question make sense?
I think so.
Okay.
Maybe I would say, start with a general comment. And this is borrowing from Richard Rohr's words. Everything belongs.
Hmm.
Every part of the story, even the ones that I really struggle with, even the disappointing ones, even the mistakes I made, even the things that I didn't make a mistake, but it was done to me, you know, just every part of the story, if I look at where I'm at right now, has a part. And I'm not one that believes God did all those things. I don't think God does terrible things to teach us stuff.
Yeah.
But I absolutely, in my core, believe that God is present even in those catastrophic moments and helps integrate that into a better story. And so I think that whole idea that everything belongs, nothing is wasted. It doesn't mean it was good. It's just not wasted. Right. And so it there's still a couple parts of my story I'm not thankful for, but I can't deny that they're part of why I'm here and who I am. So I think someday I'm going to be able to say, wow, I am so thankful that that thing fell apart. Right now I'm just like, well, let me stay neutral about it, but I can't deny what it did in me.
Right.
Yeah.
And thank God, right? Like,
oh yeah.
That he uses those things to his glory, no matter what, you know? And
One of the most compelling ideas that we tried to wrestle with a lot at the practice community was just the idea of the Paschal mystery, the life, death, resurrection, life, death, resurrection. That is the rhythm of everything. That's the rhythm of nature, of ecosystems, and that's the rhythm of a human soul. You know, it's not, Jesus didn't just live, die, and be resurrected for one single, you know, redemptive someday purpose. Jesus was also showing us what God does. And it's give yeah. life and then give new life, but yeah. in a new way. And so that has been really compelling, especially in those times of death and of yeah. loss. And again, we don't pretend we're happy about it. We don't have to pretend anymore. In fact, we can weep and weep and weep as we look for resurrection.
Yeah. Yeah. I think too, going back to your sort of like three pop songs and a hymn sort yeah. of scenario, we're so quick to move to the resurrection.
Yeah,
a lot of
right.
times we miss
that's
the
right.
life and the death.
That's
you
right.
know? And
yep.
It always makes me think of like, you know, liberation theology and, you know, the, you know, African-American experience
right.
and, they are very aware of the cross. Like the cross is
yes.
more central to their theology
yep.
than, many mainline sort of
yep. that's right.
average white churches.
That's right.
right?
That's yeah. right.
So, yeah. But again, we don't have the capacity maybe or the,
yeah.
the willingness to like sort of stay in that space,
right.
I guess. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. In fact, just today, I don't know when you're going to post this, but you know, just today, all the virus stuff is
right,
just exploding.
Right.
And a friend just said, one of the gifts and the pain of collective dread is that it exposes the private dread that we hold every day.
Yeah.
And that yeah. is, I think that is a powerful pastoral word. And
yeah.
so I think that's some of why. Why do we not do collective lament? Because we don't want to get in touch with the private lament that we're not willing to engage. So
yeah.
let's just keep the songs happy and, you know.
Right.
So
and just put on a smiling face and pretend like everything's okay.
Yep.
Because it's easier that way until it's not.
Right. I was just going to say, short term, that is much preferable.
yeah.
Let's just have fun.
So what is it? Okay, so you're in this moment and, you know, you had these sort of breakdowns of everything you believe. What would you say to somebody maybe contemplating just throwing it all out?
Yeah.
As opposed, like, why do you think you were able to, or by God's grace, sort of stuck with?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what I would say to people who are contemplating, who know it doesn't work as it is
yeah,
and are
right.
thinking about jumping ship, you're probably mostly right. Like those things that don't work, don't work. And they need to be let go of. They need to be, you're not crazy. Don't shortcut the process. Don't put a Christian bow on it. Don't clean it all up, but go through it all the way. I can respect someone who goes all the way into the darkness.
Yeah.
Because I know what's on the other side. I've experienced what's on the other side. What I don't respect is people who tiptoe into the darkness and then write a blog about it. I mean,
sure.
Either go all the way in or
yeah.
or maybe keep your opinions to yourself, you know. Go for it
yeah.
because you will be caught on the other end. You will be
yeah.
carried on the other end.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, what I would say is the good news is relentlessly good, but sometimes we need to do some very, very painful work of deconnecting it from some systems that are no longer
yeah.
good news.
Don't you think though, at the same time, if like there hasn't been a period of time where we've had to sort of like rethink all that stuff
yeah.
and sort of struggle that maybe our faith isn't as strong, or I don't even know what I'm trying to say necessarily, but there needs to be that depth.
Absolutely.
And the only way to do it is to struggle.
Oh yeah. I mean, doubt is very important part of the journey of faith. I heard
yeah.
someone say doubt is not the opposite of faith. Indifference is the opposite of faith.
Mm.
You know, doubt, man, wrestle it
yeah.
to the ground. Don't stop until you have some sort of answer, which I suspect will not be an answer in your brain, will be an answer in your bones, you know?
Yeah.
No, doubt is all part of the process.
Yeah. That's good stuff, man. That's good stuff. I literally could just sit here and talk to you.
Yeah, me too. But, yeah.
We should probably, though, you know, wrap it up at some point here. So, are you ready to jump into our... Oh, you know what? Can you just talk just briefly about what you got going on with the podcast and like the liturgy stuff some of that and where people can find you and all that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the central place to find me is just my website. It's aaronnequist.com. So that's where I try to have... There's a liturgy project there called A New Liturgy. There's the book called The Eternal Current. And that's basically just like, this is the story. This is why. This is how it happened for me. And then everything else is resources for how to flesh it out. Because there's no one size fits all. But I truly believe there are some universal practices that will help us kind of discern and move forward. So I'm doing that with some liturgy stuff. I started a podcast last summer just called the Eternal Current Podcast, and where it was going through the book. And the idea was we'd do an episode for each chapter. So we'd look at the idea, but then we'd talk to somebody who's fleshing out that idea. And then we'd always end with a concrete practice that helps us practice it.
That's good.
And so the practice is always the most important part for me because, again, ideas are helpful to get you started, but what do I do with my heart? What do I do with my body? What do I do with my actual energy? These practices are pretty helpful. So,
yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. I'm like halfway through your episode with Ruth Haley Barton.
Oh, yeah. Like, isn't she unbelievable?
Oh, my gosh.
When she made the turn to our parents, the story we heard from I was like, oh my gosh. We just like, that was a good one.
So good. So good. Yeah. Thanks, man. That's good stuff. Okay. So are you ready to jump into our final two questions?
Yep.
Okay. So my first question is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
Strangest job. I have a fun answer and I have a cynical answer. So I'll give you the fun answer.
Whatever you want to do.
I'll give you the fun answer. Okay. For 5 summers in college and right after, I was on a house painting crew.
Nice.
And it was all friends. And we had, I mean, it's hard work. And we were exhausted and you're up on a ladder and 90 degree summer heat. You know, it's not easy work, but we had a lot of fun and did some very juvenile things that we should not have been doing on the work site. But so I'd say painting houses.
I like it. That's a good one, man. Yeah. It's good. Was it mostly exterior or were you doing interior?
Almost exclusively exterior.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That's a lot harder too. Yeah. That's good.
Yep.
Okay, so my final question then is, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom more into their work?
Yeah. I would start with the good news. God's kingdom is already at your work. There is no God-forsaken place. As bad as your boss is, even your boss's office is not a God-forsaken place. Yeah. So God's already there. And God is already working. So the question is, how can you cultivate eyes to see what God is already doing in your work and then try to align both what you do and how you do it with that movement? And so sometimes that's a matter of content, like I'm going to do different kinds of things once I see how God's working. What I've found is way more often, it's a matter of posture. It's a matter of how I'm doing the thing. Yeah. A lot of my work has been church work, which is not the same as kingdom work. Yeah. I mean, you know that. I mean, you can do church work that is actually opposed to kingdom work. Right. But a lot of the kingdom work has emerged within my church work when I start noticing what's going on in the people around me.
Yeah.
And it's those moments where you get done with a meeting and you follow up and you say, hey, I sense some really sadness in your voice. What's going on? And then the kingdom work can start. Yeah. And that has nothing to do with the content of the vocation. That has everything to do with what God's already doing there and you joining it. Yeah. So I would say God is already at your work. God is already active, and God is inviting you to participate with what God is already doing. So
that's awesome. Yeah, I think that's an incredible encouragement too, just for everybody, right? Like,
yeah,
yeah,
that's yeah. We're yeah, all in ministry. Yeah, we're right? all exactly. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. You said it. You just summarize the podcast.
Oh, good.
Man. It's like,
good.
Yeah, yeah, it's perfect.
Cool.
So it's good. Well, thanks, man. It's been really fun hanging out and chatting.
Great to talk to you. Yeah.
Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing from Aaron. And I really hope this episode maybe brought you to a new level of just seeking intimacy with God. I think that's such an important value and something Aaron's so good at teaching other people to do. I encourage you just check out all of his resources. He's got amazing stuff on his website, just some in-depth stuff. And try some of these things out. Go experience God in a different way. I think that's always a value. It's always a good thing. And we are always rewarded for it, even if it doesn't feel like it in the moment, maybe. But it's a long walk with God, and it's a marathon, and it needs those sort of those disciplines and those practices in everyday life in order for us to just keep on the path. And so, yeah, I just encourage you to do all that stuff. This is a great time right now. You can scroll to the bottom of your iTunes app or whatever you're listening on, and you can leave me a rating and review. That just helps get the word out about the podcast. I greatly appreciate that, and all the support that all the listeners give. So I appreciate you doing all that. And until next time, get out there or stay in and hustle.